This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today, a special interview with Paul Merson, who's written a new book called Hooked, Addiction and the Long Road to Recovery. It covers his incredibly well-known career highs, winning leagues, playing in World Cups, all the time battling his well-known career lows, three addictions, alcohol, drugs, and most damagingly, gambling. We've discussed gambling addiction in depth on this pod. Today, we get a first-hand account of what it can do, how it affects the people you love, and the lifelong struggle to keep it under control. Also, if there's time, we'll do some punditry, talk about how great Jeff Stelling is, and discuss the hour of television that me, Merce, and Barry made that no one has ever seen, our failed TV pilot. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Hello, Barry.
Hi, Max. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Hey, Merce.
Hi, Max. Hi, Barry.
Do you think about that hour a lot, Merce?
I do. I thought it was BAFTA stuff. I seriously thought it was BAFTA. I left that show and I went and got myself a tuxedo. I bought one. I thought I'd go top of the range, but never happened.
We'll get into it in part three. I love the book, Merce. I'm not just saying that. Because you're staring at me. But if I had hated it, I'd probably still say I loved it. It sounds like you. You know, I've heard a lot of those stories quite a few times. And there are some brilliant football stories, but it is fundamentally about addiction. Why did you want to write it?
I really just found out that I was ill, really. I realize I've got an illness now, and it's not... I always thought I was a bad person trying to get good. I kept on doing what I was doing and thinking, how horrible can you be? What a bad person. And I didn't want to tell anybody that. You know, the stuff that I put in the book, I didn't want to tell anybody because I was thinking I was a bad person. Everybody's going to judge me. But when I realized that I was an ill person and I was trying to get well, then I thought, I've got to write this. I've just got to write this so I can get it out there for someone not to go through what I went through. Because there's no worse a pain. You know, it's such a bad pain of like, doing stuff like losing all your money, like losing our savings, or going out and not coming home when I've had a drink. To be fair, I've had a few people get in touch with me since, which has been nice. So it's helped more than one person, which I thought that would be job done if it helped one person.
I always thought you were a good bloke.
Yeah, no, I was always a good bloke around you. No, but you, do you know what I mean? Yeah, but you didn't know because you went home. You went home.
Yeah.
You went home. You were that person I wanted to be, you know, like... When we went out, you go, right, I'm going now. And I'm like, oh, no. Like, and I you know, mine would carry on. And that was the problem.
Merce, there's got to be people listening who will have already made their judgment about you and other addicts. And they'll say that calling your addictions an illness is a handy cop out. Can you explain to them why they're wrong?
Because it is a compulsion. As soon as I start drinking, I cannot stop. I'm not like normal people. I have an addictive compulsive disorder in my brain. You know, I've got a BBC documentary coming out on this Monday coming that highlights what it does to the brain, the addiction, what my drinking, what my gambling has done to the brain. And it's not something that it will happen to normal. I say normal people. It's just that I've started at 16 years of age, Barry, and my brain process, it thinnens and I don't see risk. I've heard loads of people go, I'll just stop, show some self-will. Okay, next time you get diarrhea, just try and stop it with self-will. With the gambling, it's very still, I still think there's a stigma around the gambling because you don't put anything in you. You know, if I said to, I'd say to Max, oh, I'm having a bet. And he's seen me bet loads of times. You know, and people go, oh, it's a mug's game. Gambling's a mug's game. So they don't understand. But if I said I'm going out for a drink all night or I'm an alcoholic, people go, and you, like, I've done a thing the other day, a podcast with someone, and they went, how long are you now without a drink? And I went, nearly 3 years in January. They went, well done. They went, how long are you without a bet? And I went, just over a year. He went, right, let's start. I said, you didn't say well done when I said over a year. And he went, oh, yeah. And it is because he doesn't understand. He probably never had a bet in his life before. So he doesn't understand. You know, people go, it's a mug's game. It is an illness. It's a compulsion. I can't stop it. I become powerless over it. It controls my life. It takes me over. It's It's scary. And that was a good question, Barry. And did I answer it properly? I ain't sure about that. You know, I'm not bright enough to sort of think. All I know that when I start gambling, it takes me over, and I will keep on betting till I'm down to zero. And if I showed you my accounts and my bets, it's madness.
When I read that you'd lost everything again in the first lockdown, I found that sort of heartbreaking. I was under the sort of misapprehension when we worked together as well, that you were sort of, you had it under control. You were betting all the time on everything, you know, IPL, baseball, whatever, in ad breaks, during shows, whatever. But I don't know if naively I thought you did. What happened in the first lockdown?
Being an addictive person, I got addicted to the news. Just kept on watching the news, got addicted to it. Found myself at 5 o'clock sitting down watching Boris Johnson, like, and his two people talking, and got scared, like, got massive anxiety attacks, got scared, and thought, this is it. We're never getting out of this. I'm going to lose my job. Every game was live on the telly. I thought that soccer Saturday is never happening again. You know, just going to have every game on a Saturday. This is my brain telling me all this. And we had a deposit for a house, and I thought, this is where my thinking goes out the window. My thinking was, right, let's race it up and get enough money to be able to survive for the next 10 years, because this is not going to get us through much. And I lost it all, lost everything. And I didn't tell Kate for about a week or so. And every time I looked at the kids, and I'd hate myself with a passion. I mean, with a passion, I'd sit there and I'd look at them. They were like 5 and 3. And I'd be like, I just couldn't help myself. I hated myself. I just wanted to kill myself, if I'm being honest. I just thought, I've let you down so badly. Thinking that I did do it, do you know what I mean? But it is like, it is a compulsion, and it's something that, you know, I have to arrest every day. But yeah, it was the best money I've ever lost. If that makes any sense, it ain't helped us with a house. We live in a rented house, but it's woke me up. Do you know what I mean? And now it's over a year without a bet. So sometimes there's a reasons for things to happen, but you know, I don't think Kate says that. Well, she does say that, but she still thinks we should have a house.
How do you have that conversation with your wife? Presumably she knew what she was signing up for.
No chance.
No?
Absolutely not a chance. Not in a million years. Nah, not in a million years. She knew I liked to drink. Not a doubt about that. She knew that. And I think she knew that at the time. I think when I weren't coming home and the phone was ringing, yeah, I think then she was like, you know what? With the gambling, no chance. Not a chance. I mean, it's hard to be around gambling. My first wife was around around when I was bang on the cocaine. And people go, oh, how did you not see that? How did you not? If you've not been around that and you don't know, you know, the one thing with compulsive gamblers is, if it was in the Olympics, we'd represent our country at lying. You know, it becomes, because when you're a compulsive gambler and you lie, you've still got your wits about you. If you've gone out and had 15 pints of lager and you come home and your wife's waiting for you, you start telling her a load of lies, by week Tuesday, you forgot what you said. And it's harder to keep them lies going constantly. With the gambling, it's very easy to keep them going. No, my wife wouldn't have, she, in her wildest dreams, she wouldn't have thought about the gambling. But the big advantage is as it went on, her mum's dad had a major gambling problem. And if it wasn't for her, Kate wouldn't have been with me. She'd have left me a long time ago. I think it was only with her mum saying, as it got worse, you know, he's got a major problem. Your granddad was like that. And I think that was the one thing that sort of kept her hanging around, thank God.
There are so many stories in the book about crazy bets or continuous bets. You know, the wedding day in 1990 when you put so much money on Scotland to beat Costa Rica. You know, the day your son Charlie's in labour, you know, gambling on Deal or No Deal with a mate just ringing him up and saying it. And when we talk about gambling, and often when we do interviews like this or you see TV programmes about this, people want to hear, what was the biggest bet? What was the stupidest wager? Because people, I guess, want a headline. Do you think that kind of line, before I ask you what your biggest bet was, no, do you think that kind of glamorizes it? Or is it a fair question, or is it actually quite unhelpful in the idea of understanding it?
Yeah, I think so. Because people who listen to this, you know, you hope someone's listening to this. They need to listen to the similarities. Don't listen to the differences. Don't go, well, I never lost £7 million, so I haven't got a problem till I lose £7 million. It's not the money. You know, in Gamblers Anonymous, no one talks about money. It's nothing to do. You know, if you're a professional footballer and you're on £50,000 a week and you're losing £30,000 a week on gambling, and you're a postman who's on £500 a week and you're losing £501 a week in gambling, you have 100 times worse a problem than the professional footballer. You know, you're doing everything, you know, because he's losing £30,000, you're losing £501. His £501 a lot more dangerous because he's losing everything. The other bloke still got money. So it's not about the money. You know, I lost time. I lost time. It was only in, I've been to Florida every year for a lot of years. I love Florida. I'd always take the kids. It was only 2 years ago or so that I see my kids' faces in Disney and how much they liked it. First time ever. And I've took all the kids there and I love them dearly. But that's the first time I've ever seen their faces where I've gone, wow, they love it here. Because I'm so interested in looking at my phone and gambling and I'm never in the moment. It's been sad because I never live in the moment. I always bet and drink to get out of the way I feel and not to be in the moment. And now I live in the moment, which is, I'm not going to say it's easy because for 36 years, I haven't done that.
We did a show about gambling addiction with a guy called James Grimes, he's a gambling addict. He does amazing work with The Big Step and Gambling with Lives and campaigns a lot for the amount of sort of gambling advertising. He's at football grounds, on football shirts, on advertising. And he remembered being at the bedside of one of his parents who was dying and being on a roulette wheel, you know, and then just when he looks back now and thinking, how could I be doing that at that time? And that being a kind of rock bottom moment. And I mean, there are a number of times in that book where you think, was there a moment? I appreciate I'm asking that your biggest bet or your worst moment question. I just wonder if there is a moment where you almost step back and went, the fuck am I doing here?
£10,000 on a table tennis player.
On a table tennis player?
£10,000 on a table tennis player.
Was it Desmond Douglas? It's the only one I know.
No, you know what? I couldn't even tell you his name. Some Russian. You know, that's when I thought, wow, where's this taken me? Where has this taken me? I'm just betting for the sake of betting. You know, but this has been going on years. I mean, I had £8,000 on someone to win the Eurovision Song Contest. I've had, you know, it's like as that what you just said then, that man sitting at the bed of his dying dad and he's on the roulette machine. Now, please someone tell me that people are going to sit there and think, oh, my God, that's just weak. That's just weak-willed. That's how compulsive and compulsion this is. It's like it's just madness. It takes over. You know, I got accounts with betting shops that I've had like 100 bets a day, 100 bets a day, you know, not two or three, 100 bets a day. Now, surely there are triggers for these companies to go, wait there a minute, the geezer's not well. It's not well. I've got to stop this. You know, so that was disappointing. But, you know, this is a compulsion. It's like when I went out and drank, I couldn't catch my breath. I was fascinated when you used to go home. I was fascinated.
I was tired.
How can you stop now? Yeah, exactly. But so was I. But I'd still carry on. And that's what I couldn't work out. If someone come into a pub where I used to drink and have two pints and go home, I used to sit there and go, why would you come in and just have two pints? What's the point? Why would you do that? But that's what people do. You know, it's only people like me and a lorry load of other people do is as soon as I started, I couldn't tell you when I was going to stop. That was with gambling and drinking and drugs. I just didn't know when the stop was.
I was chatting to a pal of mine who's a recovering alcoholic about saying we were doing this interview today. And he was saying that if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous or Gamblers Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous, that you admit you're powerless over the booze or the dogs or the coke. And that's meant to be liberating, an admission of defeat and a sort of a clean slate. But he said some people take this to mean that you get a free pass to fuck up every now and then, which isn't quite the same.
True.
Are you in that bracket? Have you got a sort of air of fatalism that it's part of the Merce narrative that you're going to mess up every now and then?
No, not really. Because now I know. Before I didn't know. I didn't know I was powerless over alcohol and gambling. I just thought I was. I just thought I was, as you would say, like either weak or just not a nice person. Really, I used to think. I didn't think I was. There was a problem. I just thought I was one of the lads, and I just done it to the extreme. But no, I mean, it petrifies me. You know, I can't go back. How many times can I go back? The insanity of going back when you know you're not well. It's like if I said to you now you've got a nut allergy and you went out and bought a packet of peanuts and ate them, what's the result? You're in trouble, major trouble. And that's, I know now. I know I can't drink, I can't think. You know, before people have been all right, you know, been quite understanding of me. You know, I've relapsed before, my wife and people and family, and even the public have been very, very understanding. I don't see that now. If I go back tomorrow morning or I go back next week, whenever, I don't expect anybody to say, oh my God, oh yeah, that's just the normal thing. You know, he's an addict. You know, why wouldn't you go back? No, I don't work it like that. You know, my thing is get up in the morning and I say to myself, don't drink, don't take drugs and don't gamble today. And that's it. If you said to me now, Barry, you can never take, drink, drugs or gamble again for the rest of your life, I'll be out tomorrow morning. I just couldn't do it. I'd find it so overwhelming that I would be back at it tomorrow morning. But when I say to myself, I could just do it for today. You know, the other week I struggled. The American football was on and I was struggling. You know, bit of a trigger. You know, I love the American football. Big thing for me. Always used to watch it. You know, I had to go to bed at 7:45 at night just to get away from it because I could feel myself. I could feel the compulsion. Even though I've got so many blocks in the way to have a bet, it was still worrying. And I just took myself to bed and I thought, well, you know, get up in the morning, it's a different day. And that's how it gets sometimes. I'm not going to lie. It's not, you know, I stopped and it's a walk in the park. You know, I get up in the morning and sing zippity-doo-dah, zippity-day. Do you know what I mean? It's this is 36 years of what I've done to now. This is completely different life. My life's either been right up high in the sky, scoring goals, playing in front of 40,000 people, winning loads of money, or right down at the bottom here, lost everything, played badly, team have played bad, either played bad myself or out the team. And it's been a roller coaster, and I've been comfortable with that. That's been my life. Now, all of a sudden, I've got that steady, what I would call normal life, whatever a normal life is. And I find it so hard sometimes. I've strived for this for 36 years, just to be able to come and sit on here, talk to you and Matt, and talk openly and honest, and not be looking at my phone every 2 minutes and thinking, oh, what's on next? And, you know, if it's winning, I'm all happy and Larry. And if it's losing, I'm like, oh, come on, hurry up. You know, I've got to get another bet on. And I'm not going to lie, some days it is hard. I don't want people to sit here and go, oh my God, yeah, you know, stop drinking, stop gambling, stop taking drugs and life is great. It's better. And most days, the good days majorly outweigh the bad days. But there are hard days. You know, I see certain things, Barry, triggers, you know, like Max just said about adverts on the telly. They're major triggers. They're dangerous. They're dangerous. I see them. I hear them on the radio at 7 o'clock in the morning. Oh, Man United evens to beat Southampton. And I hear my head say to me, evens. Wouldn't hurt, would it? Evens. Do you know what I mean? One bet. And then I just have a bet next week. I know full well now, and I know, and I've seen the patterns. Within 2 days, I'll be betting on Lithuanian under-20s basketball, playing on a mountain with a balloon.
I'd rather bet on them than Manchester United these days.
Yeah. You're not wrong.
It does remind me of walking into the green room at Sky once, and I was like, all right, Merce. And you're just looking up at me and going, ah, the fuck, a Dynamo Tbilisi, 3-0 down at home. I was like, why are you asking me that? I've got no idea.
Exactly. And that's what it was like. They were the bets.
That'll do for part one. We'll be back in just a second. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Me, Barry and Paul Merson. Can I ask you a personal question, Merce? I mean, they have been quite personal so far, to be fair.
Yeah.
There's a quote in the book that says, how can I get money tomorrow? Who can I ring up that I've paid back quickly enough the last time that will lend me money again? That kills you inside. Because you called me once and I did lend you money, you didn't call me again because, you know, you didn't start paying it back for quite a long time. But I wonder what that, and I don't know if you remember it as vividly as I do because,
yeah,
because
I remember,
no one, yeah, like yesterday. You know, no,
like yesterday.
You've asked lots, I guess you've asked lots of people for money. That process for you to sit there and think, right, I've got to text Max and ask him this. Are you in a state of desperation that you're sending millions of texts, or are you thinking, I can ask this person once, or I can ask this person 10 times, or what?
Good question. Oh, yeah, I remember it. I mean, that's the thing it does. It takes your self-worth, self-esteem away. Like, well, you would like go, oh, you know, let's just be friends still, and he'll pay me back when he pays back at the time. Mine I hate myself. You know, at the time, I have no self-respect to myself. I have no thought of like asking people for money, and people like, no disrespect, who don't earn more money than I do. You know what I mean? That's the thing. And it was like, and that's what I hated myself for. And I didn't talk to you for ages. You know, I ducked talking to you, and that's not right, because we're good friends. Do you know what I mean? We're very close to each other, and that's what addiction does. It takes you away from people who talk sense. It don't want you around people like you. You know, don't want level grounded people who, as I say, when they've had enough to drink or they're going to start getting enough to drink, I'm off. You know, they wouldn't go mad at gambling. And the stuff you come out with to say you need the money as well, it's just, it was mind-blowing. That's where it was dangerous. The lies were like good. They were great. And, you know, it just kills yourself.
The fact you wanted tickets to the opera really did surprise me, but
I know, yeah. I wanted to fly to Australia with Kate just to go and watch something. Yeah, I can't believe you believe me.
Like, we worked together for a few years, right? And we talked about it a lot. I saw you gambling a lot. I probably wanted to tell myself it was fine. And we'd go to the pub, and I never really saw you pissed because I got pissed quicker than you, or I'd gone home. But could I have done, like, there'll be people listening who have a mate who's an addict. Could I have done more? Could I have done anything? I probably never sat down with you and said, how are you? What are you doing? You know, I never did that. I never wondered if I did wonder if I could have done something, but could I have been useful at all?
You know what? You haven't been around it, so you don't understand, really. So it's a bit different. You know, like, mine's a bit different when I was on Harry's Heroes with Neil Ruddock and I fronted Neil about his drinking. It was only because I'd been in that position before and I didn't want to see him. And I know Neil since I was 16, and I didn't want to see him go down the same path. And I could see it. I could see it because I'd been there. So I just thought, I've got to say something. Otherwise, I couldn't live with myself. If something happened to Neil, and I thought, why didn't I just at least say something? It's different for you. You haven't been in that position. You don't know what's going on in my head. You're not a compulsive gambler. You're not an alcoholic. You're not a drug addict. So it's hard for you to understand. You know what I mean? So if you was in that position and you were 10 years sober or 3 or 4 years sober and you never pulled me, and then you know, I'd be sitting here thinking maybe Max could have probably just pulled us one day and just put a seed in my head, but why would you? You haven't been around addictions. Do you know what I mean? And
when you gave Razor his pep talk, he didn't appreciate it, but he probably knew you were right, and that's probably what annoyed him.
Yeah, and that's right. That, yeah, of course. You know, he hit a nerve, and it's only because I'd seen it and I've been there before, and that's why. Of course, it did. And then it just puts that seed in him where, you know, you just think, you know, I hope he gets it. But I'm not a preacher. I'm not one of these people go around and go, oh, please stop this, please stop that. You know, nobody should ever gamble again. Yeah. If I could gamble, Barry, I'd be gambling. If I could gamble normally, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I'm not going to lie, I just couldn't control it. You know, drinking, I didn't really love drinking. I never went in a pub and got a pint and went, that was lovely. I just drank. But the gambling, I loved gambling. But, I'm not going to go around and go to people, ban gambling forever. No, don't get, why? You know, some people enjoy it, very enjoy it, and it's a buzz for them, but there's people like me who can't. It's impossible to gamble reasonably. You know, when I look back now, a lot of people took me for a ride. You know, a lot of people took me for a ride where they knew more than me, and that was what I don't like. But, hey-o, you know, you just got to let go of that.
There were two questions I had One is, how do you feel about those private bookies that kept taking your bets? Because there's no one in football who doesn't know that Paul Merson's a gambling addict.
There was a company called, I won't be able to name it because they won't be able to back themselves up in here, but a gambling company. I had to go through my inventory, like with my accounts. In 2017, in a 3 month, just over a 3 month period, I lost £135,000 in 4 months, just under 4 months. That, now work that out, you'd have to earn some money to do that. And I wrote to them, I sent them an email, and I just said, I've just gone through my thing, I've just seen how much I lost it. I personally think you let me down. I mean, there should have been enough triggers there. And they went, we'll have a look. We'll have a look at the situation. And they were not, they went, we'll have a look. So they sent me all the stuff. Now I'm having 60, 70 bets a day. Like, not every day, but over the 4 months. On my accounts, I'm depositing, like, say, in a 3 day span, I've deposited £4,000, £3,000, £2,000, £1,000, £3,000, £4,000, £1,000, £69. Because that's all I got left, £69. So it's not the money, it's just the bet. Now that's a trigger. Now, if you go through the accounts, it's lending money off everybody. If they'd have asked for my bank accounts, they'd have seen Paul Merson lends off Max Rushton straight into a bookmaker's account. Bang, off my sister, straight into a bookmaker's account. Everything was borrowed to feed my addiction. They went, we'll have a look at it. They come back, said, we did nothing wrong. We rung you to see if you was all right. And you said you was all right. So that was the box that they had to tick, which is bordering on a disgrace, really, if I'm being honest. I mean, I have a picture of them all sitting in the office and going, because you know a compulsive gambler or a gambling person with a gambling disorder by the bets you have. And I can imagine putting it on loudspeaker and going, all come round here. I know what he's going to say. He's going to say he's 50 years of age and he's all right. And that's why I say, why would someone with a gambling problem want to close an account down where that feeds him?
What's it like to owe money, not to mates, right? You've got the shame. I'm not going to answer the phone, but like, yeah. I'm not going to come around your house with a baseball bat, right?
I would love to see you do that.
Yeah.
What's it like to owe money to bad people?
Not good. Not good. It's not good. It's not good. That's what happens. You get involved with people you owe money to, and the interest rate is through the roof. It's through the roof. It's, you know, you're paying interest back, and you're not even touching the surface of the debt. And then all of a sudden it's a merry-go-round. So you're thinking, I can't pay this. So I need to lend some money. For instance, I lend some money off of Max. And what I have to do is try and turn this into double money so I can pay Max back. And then I can go and pay the interest on this. And then I lose that. And then I have to go there again. And then I have to borrow off. And it's a circle.
Can I ask about drugs, which is not an area of expertise for me? The scariest parts, I think, of the whole book are the paranoia you experienced when you were taking a lot of cocaine, and the idea that you even thought you were being followed to training, whereby it was like some kind of weird FBI film. Like, what is that experience like?
When I watched the Truman Show, it petrified me. I couldn't watch the older Truman Show. It petrified me. That's what it was like, a bit like that. It was. I was that petrified. It'd take me an hour to get to work in the morning. If anybody was behind me in the car for more than 10 seconds, I'd pull over. I think they were going to kill me. I mean, I lived in this little cul-de-sac when I was at Arsenal, and it had gates. So at the bottom of the road, I'd pull in. And as I pulled in the house, if there was a car parked on the road, just parked on the road with someone sitting in it, could be doing anything, waiting for their wife, waiting for their husband, boyfriend, whatever, or reading the paper, I'd pull up and get out. And if my dad was with me or someone, I'd go, Dad, just go down there and just see what that man's sitting in the car for. That's how my brain used to work, you know, and it was paranoia. I mean, I'd have times where I'd go out weekend and I'd be with a girl or be with someone. And then on Saturday, I couldn't play well Saturday. Because if I score Saturday and I'm in the paper Sunday, that person will see me in the paper and go, I was with him last weekend. I'll sell my story. And that's how my brain used to work. It was that shot. But it was weird. For 11 months, I had that. And I know how bad drugs is. I know how bad what it done to me, the paranoia. I know everything. And then the drinking over the years. I mean, when you're on the front pages of the newspaper, when you're a youngster playing at Arsenal, there's a bit of an ego trip to it, you know, on the front page, bit of a laugh, you know, this. And then you sort of know. But with the gambling, it's not, you're not putting anything in you. It's not like, I've got to get drunk or get high. I've got to do something. It's in you already. And that's the worrying thing.
You mentioned earlier, and I think it'd be sort of a dereliction of duty if we didn't bring it up, but it's kind of an obvious question. Trigger words tempting you to have a bet on a game or whatever because you hear an ad. You work in an environment that's saturated with gambling advertising, and people are going to say, well, that's a bit hypocritical. And I think it's one of the basic tenets of recovery that you should remove yourself from dangerous environments. So I also know you have to earn a living. So how do you reconcile one with the other?
That is a good question. I have to get, on a Saturday, I have to make sure I get up in the morning and I talk to a friend of mine in GA. And then I sort of talk before I go into work, 100%, you know. I'm watching something I'm watching something I absolutely love. I love football. It's my life. It's been my life since I'm going to go far back as 7, 8, 9 years of age. It's everything I've always wanted to do. So I love watching football. I don't watch a lot of tennis anymore. I don't watch cricket. I don't watch basketball, baseball, you know. Might watch the American football every now and then. The other Sunday, I couldn't watch it because I didn't feel good. So the other sports, you ask Max, with the other sports, Barry, he could ask me any question about any other sport and I could tell you every result that happened, who's playing next week, who's going to play this week, who's playing, who's injured. I knew everything. With the football, it's because I love it. I can do it. If you said to me now, who's playing in the IPL today, I wouldn't have a clue.
That's so refreshing. Honestly, that's so refreshing to hear. Because 3-4 years ago when we were working, yeah.
You know, over a year ago, I'd tell you who was playing, who's what the batting averages and everything, and it still didn't help me win.
Suffering Villain says, not a question. Having been through the same experience as myself, I found the hardest part is the lack of understanding from others. Any other illnesses, you get sympathy, but addiction turns people against you. That's what hurts the most. I can handle living in debt for the rest of my life. It's losing friends that really hurts. His book will help some people understand that addiction is an illness. So thank you, Mercer. I read it all in one sitting. That's from Suffering Villain. That'll do for part two. We'll do a bit of punditry in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We should talk about football, Merce. And actually, talk about Sky, because you do say in the book that they have been like amazingly supportive. And you talk actually about football being such a, you know, there are so many fine margins. And the fact that Arsenal got to that Champions League final, which was not necessarily a high chance of that happening, meant that you were being a panellist that got you in front of them and they noticed something. They noticed that you're good at it, right?
Yeah, well, I think I noticed I had an opinion. I know my football and I have an opinion. I think... And that was it. I was fortunate. I was very fortunate. And things happened in the game where there was opinions to have, you know, sending offs and goals and things. So for me, you know, I'll be the first. You got to be lucky in life in certain things. Of course you do. You need breaks. You know, I played 700 football matches, won everything in the game by what it was called then, the European Cup. I'm still lucky to be a footballer. Of course I was. I had to get a lucky break along the way. I didn't, you know, it wasn't like, put on a pair of boots, you're going to make it. So you've got to be lucky. Sky have been great for me. I dread to think where I'd be. I mean, people like, you know, Barney Francis and Gary Hughes have been massively understanding.
Hang on, Barney sacked me, mate. That's not going too far.
Yeah, but you know, with me, you know, that's what. But for me, it was like he was understanding. He was very helpful for me. Gary Hughes, you know, I've been into their room and said, you know, I've just tried to commit suicide. Do you know what I mean? You know, that I've put a lot of stuff on them. It's not like I've, you know, they've been there, you know, they've been helpful and whatever, you know, whatever you need to do, whatever you want us to do, you know, even like when that happened, you know, for the next 2-3 weeks, you know, checking in, make sure I'm all right, which, you know, which I'll never forget. Do you know what I mean? I'll never forget that. You know, I have a good memory. Do you know what I mean? Of people that have been good, and you know, and there's a lot of good people out there, and you know, and Kondo, who, you know, give me my break on Soccer Saturday. You know, you're talking a dyslexic, you know, someone who's dyslexic, who's not very clever, and I'm not, you know, I'm streetwise, and I'm, you know, and I know my football, but I'm dyslexic, and to get on a live TV program with the names that some of the players have got now, with like, some of them have got like three silent letters in it. I mean, it's like, I've never, when I was at school, I don't even think there was a silent letter. And they've just said, just get on with it. Just, you know, just be yourself. Because after my first couple of shows, I'm like, I rang him up. I said, do I need to go on a journalist course and all that, you know? And he just said, no, just be yourself. Be yourself. And that's an amazing thing when a massive company like Sky can say, just be yourself. Don't be anybody different. Be yourself. And that's all I've ever done. Half the people in the world love me. The other half can't stand me. I know that. That's a fact.
But you are the subject of a lot of unkind comments about your inability to pronounce certain footballers' names, which genuinely isn't your fault, because you are dyslexic.
Yeah.
And you say in the book that the letters sort of swim around and move around.
Yeah.
Because you grew up in a generation where, I guess, dyslexia probably wasn't a thing. You were just thick, which is pretty unfair. Now people recognise dyslexia is a... is it a disease or an affliction or whatever? I don't know.
So I think it's a hard thing, as you say. It's still one of them things where, you know, people say, oh, your writing's amazing. My writing is like second to none. You know, it's so neat because I have to concentrate on
your handwriting.
It's major.
It's amazing.
I mean, it's the only
thing. It's amazing.
It's the only thing that stopped me from being a doctor, if I'm being honest. It's just too good. Like, I was writing out prescriptions and everybody could understand them. So they said, you know, knock that on the head. But I accept that. I accept it like I accept now. You know my football. I have an opinion. Some of the names I can't say. I mean, it took me 6 years to now Ali Adier, and now he doesn't play football. So, you know.
I remember we had a lot of fun with Britta Sombolonga.
Oh, don't.
Took about 25 minutes.
You know, sometimes I can say it, Max. It's just when it's in the heat of the moment, like Peroni. Like, I kept on calling him Peroni, but looking back now, I can understand why I was calling him that.
I mean, do you still love it? Obviously, it's changed with the panel, but Jeff is still there. Were you sort of, you know, I've been there. You know what it's like when your contract's running down. It's a nerve-wracking time. No one will do it forever. None of us are indispensable. So, like, are you still just overjoyed to be doing it? Because it is, you know, it has been an iconic show for so long.
Yeah, I love it. I'm very, as I said before, I'm very fortunate. I had the best job in the world playing football. I honestly feel I had the second best job now, and I do love it. Yeah, I thought it was one of them jobs where you look at Tomo, who's like, it was amazing for me. He was absolutely brilliant. You know, someone I majorly respect to. I always think, I wish I was like him. You know, he was someone I always think, I hope I grow up to be like him. And when they, you know, you're looking, he's 60 odd years of age, you're thinking, I've got this job for quite a long time. As long as you don't go and do something silly or go and swear on TV, you know, you got this job. And then one day you get a phone call off Gary and said, have you talked to the lads yet? And I hadn't. And they'd been released. That was scary at the highest level. That was scary because, you know, that was a good team. That was a good team, you know. And they were my mates. And I rang up Tomo straight away and I said, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to leave? Do you want me to resign? Like, and he said, whatever happens, you absolutely do not do that. You do not do that. You know, people move on in football and people move on. No, you stay. And I thought that was a massive thing. I did. I was on my knees when he said it because I thought, if he says I do, I'm like, I've got nothing. Like, I got nothing. I'm like, please. I said, I rang him from a church. Like, I was like praying, please don't. And he was nice as pie. The lads were as good as gold. And it was hard at first. When the other lads come in, you know, being dyslexic, they made me feel very comfortable. I'd mess up the names. They'd laugh at me. And, you know, as Barry just said, you didn't feel dopey. You didn't feel thick, you know, because, you know, I'm 53 now. I'm not a 7 or 8 year old with this. I'm 53. And they made me feel comfortable. And then when the other lads come on, who are great lads, I'd mess the name up and it'd just go quiet. It'd just go silent. And I used to think, oh no, You know,
they don't know how to react.
Yeah, and in this day and age now, Max, you don't, do you? You know, if you laugh, then, you know, I could turn around and go, "Oh, you're laughing at?" They'd probably be sacked. Do you know what I mean? Because you've hurt my feelings. But it wasn't. And they're nice lads. I know Clinton. I'm a massive fan of Clinton. He has a massive opinion. I like him. He's bubbly. He reminds me of me. He's a younger me. You know, and I've known Ender since he was 18 years of age. So Tim Sherwood, I played with Tim. I have massive respect for Tim. And Michael Dawson's come in, and you'd think he'd been doing it for 20 years, because it's a hard gig. People think, oh, I'll come on there and I'll do it. You've got to think, you've got to be a professional footballer, especially in this day and age where they've got to go and get professional footballers to come out the game, one, be a talker, and two, have an opinion. And there's two things that really, when you're a professional footballer playing in the Premier League mainly, you're not allowed to do. You know, when do you ever hear players give interviews? Very rarely. And they don't say anything controversial. And that's what you need to say. You have to have an opinion. So it's a hard gig. And I think, Matt, you know, Tim's definitely got one. Clinton's got one. Enders. And I like Chris Boyd as well. And Michael Dawson's come in. You'd think he'd been doing it 20 years.
Jack says, how am I supposed to get through the rest of my life knowing that we were denied Baz on the telly? I'm not even joking. This has made me sad. Our Sky Sports pilot, the three of us, I genuinely came off thinking, I've done a lot of auditions and pilots and stuff, and I haven't got many gigs. And I thought, we have absolutely nailed that. I was like, that is an hour of... It was The Debate. Do you remember the people listening from the UK will know the show The Debate? It was like three-hander, subjects, chat about them. And I was told, just do what you do on the radio. And I don't think they'd heard me, Barry, on the radio before. Because at one point during the pilot...
Then we start talking about the royal family.
We talked about that. At one point during the debate, I asked, a question came in, which was, would Merce prefer spoons for hands or forks for feet, right? And we spent 5 minutes on it. And you answered it very... Your first point was, where am I? Am I on the beach? And it... That is a difficult surface to walk on. And I thought, this is brilliant. This is fun, interesting telly. When I then saw what the debate was, I realised that perhaps we hadn't necessarily pitched the tone.
Well, yeah, it was sort of
the right place.
Jeff Shreves didn't ask Roy Keane and Jamie Carragher whether they would rather have spoons for hands or forks for feet. I think that may have been our downfall. But I've never done a pilot before, and I thought it was terrific.
I enjoyed it. I thought it was very. I like the way we all come off at the end and went, that was good.
Everyone in the gallery going, this is the worst one.
Yeah,
this is absolutely not happening.
Yeah,
burn this tape.
Yeah, pulling it away.
Oh, well. You never know. There's still time.
You know, someone's going to try and find that now, don't you?
Someone's going to try and like find to see it.
Yeah.
Go in the office and ask them, say, go on. There's no danger. At least for 3 years, I'm in Australia. There's no danger of it happening. You know, what if it went out and people loved it so much that they had to give us a show? It's possible, isn't it?
You never know.
Now you're laughing. Now you're just laughing politely.
Yeah, Merce. I am.
Right. Listen. Thanks so much, Merce, for coming.
Pleasure.
On. We appreciate
it.
The book is great, and I recommend everybody buys it. It's called Hooked. And, you know, you can get it wherever you get your books. If you have been affected by anything we've talked about, I'm going to read out a load of numbers in just a second. But for the time being, Paul, thanks for coming on, mate.
Cheers, Max. Cheers, Barry.
I'll speak to you soon.
Cheers, Paul.
Cheers. Thanks. Bye.
Now, if any parts of that conversation have affected you or you are struggling with any of those issues, and I appreciate there are a lot of them, there are a few numbers and helplines that you can call. In the UK and Ireland, Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123 or email joe@samaritans.org or joe@samaritans.ie. In the US, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is at 800-273-8255 or chat for support. You can also text HOME to 741741 to connect with a crisis text line counsellor. In Australia, the Crisis Support Service Lifeline is 131114. Other international helplines can be found at befrienders.org. So that's befrienders.org. On the subject of substance abuse in the UK, Action on Addiction is available on 0300 330 0659. In the US, Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, their national helpline is at 800 662 4357. And in Australia, the National Alcohol and Other Drug Hotline is at 1800 250 015. Families and friends can seek help at Family Drug Support Australia at 1300 368 186. If you've been affected by gambling or any part of that discussion, GamCare in the UK offers free information, support and counselling for problem gamblers. It runs the National Gambling Helpline, which is on 0808 8020 133, and also offers face-to-face counselling. If you're in the US, National Problem Gambling Helpline is 1800 522 4700. And if you're in Australia, the National Gambling Helpline is 1800 858 858. And thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back on Thursday.
This is The Guardian.